It's 10:06. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're going to talk about Title IX. And the genesis of this discussion is that this year marks the 35th anniversary of the passage of this law, the first comprehensive federal law to prohibit sex discrimination against students and employees of educational institutions. We're going to talk about the history of the law and how far we've come since then. And we have two guests to help us to discuss this issue, and we want you to help us discuss it as well. So here are the phone numbers to call. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. And in Milwaukee, please use our local number, 227-2050, 227-2050. And I would like to introduce my guests this hour. First, Dr. Bernice Sandler, Senior Scholar, Women's Research and Education Institute. Ms. Sandler played a vital role in the development and passage of Title IX, and the New York Times has referred to her as the godmother of Title IX. Good morning, Dr. Sandler.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here.
And also joining us by telephone is Dr. Karen McTighe-Musil, Senior Vice President of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. Her article, Scaling the Ivory Towers, appears in the fall 2007 edition of Ms. Magazine. Good morning to you as well.
Good morning, John. Very nice to be here.
Well, thank you for taking time to join us today. First of all, to comply with our promise that we were going to discuss the history of this bill, why don't we start at the beginning and kind of the origins of Title IX and how we got it? That might be a good place to start. And perhaps Dr. Sandler, you'd like to lead off since you were heavily involved in that.
Yes, I was, and I'll try and shorten the story. I was working at the University of Maryland, and they had about seven openings, and they didn't even consider me for them. So I went to one of my male faculty friends and said, how come, why not? And he said, well, let's face it, you come on too strong for a woman. This was in about 1969. I went home, and I literally cried. I had said, I shouldn't have ever talked, you know, up in class. I never should have talked at staff meetings, etc. And my then husband was very sympathetic. He said, are there strong men in the department? And I said, yes, they're all strong. And he said, then it's not you, it's sex discrimination. And this was a kind of new word for me. This is, in 1969, women's issues are kind of new. But I thought about it, had some additional similar experiences in the next few months, and then began to read up on the law, believing that if it was immoral, it probably should be illegal, and discovered there were no laws prohibiting sex discrimination in education. Anybody could discriminate against women teachers or administrators at all levels of education, and there were no laws protecting women and girls from sexual harassment, from any kind of sexual discrimination. I figured out if there weren't any laws, I found a little-known presidential order that prohibited all forms of discrimination in employment by federal contractors, made the connection that universities had federal contracts, and began filing charges. You didn't need to be a lawyer to do this because it's a charge with the government. It's not a lawsuit. And I filed about 250 charges, and some of the women in Congress, particularly Representative Edith Green from Portland, Oregon, and some others, and Patsy Mink and a few good men, took up the issues. And Title IX was eventually born, and the rest is really history at this point.
And I guess the only thing I would add to that, this is Karen speaking, is that all of this consciousness about equality really is part of that larger struggle for full opportunities in our diverse democracy in the United States that came out of the civil rights movement and was spurred by the very dramatic importance of trying to end what was essentially a segregated history in the United States, de jure in the South and de facto in the North. So a lot of the civil rights legislation that began to add sex or gender to that language, along with race, forbidding discrimination, fertilized the ground so that when you're talking about equality, it had a kind of resonance by 1972 that it would not have had in 1952.
So Title IX becomes the law of the land. What happened next? How has it worked out?
Well, the next thing that happens is once you have a law, and Title IX has magnificent language, but it's vague in terms of what specifically it will do. It says something like, no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation, be denied the benefits of, or be subject to discrimination under any educational program or activity receiving federal funds. And so the government then has to figure out, what does this mean, be denied the benefits or be subject to discrimination? They had to write a regulation. It took them, Title IX was passed in 72, it did not get passed till 75, and it didn't go into effect till 76, so a whole generation of particularly high school students and some college students had no benefit from Title IX at all. The regulation had to cover every single area and was not easy. There were some areas which are fairly easy to do. You know, if you don't let women take a criminal justice course because they might be exposed to male offenders, you have to let them take it, or nobody can have the course either. And that's fairly easy. But some things like athletics turned out to be much harder. And it took a while for it to come out. I think one of the most interesting things was when Title IX was passed, we had very little idea of how it was going to cover athletics. We knew that it would, but we really didn't understand it because nobody had done any studies of the discrimination in higher education in sports or even in K-12. And my idea of how sports was going to be covered was, isn't this nice when they have a day devoted to sports, field day it's called in some places, they'll have more games for girls. There was a lot of opposition to Title IX covering sports once the sports establishment found out that it would.
And at that time, and I'm trying to, it's too long ago in my history to remember the exact year, but when I was a young instructor, so it probably would have been before 74, because that's when I became an assistant professor, finished my doctorate, I was asked to be the Title IX coordinator, and I had just gone to a school that had gone co-ed in 1970, and I came there in 71. And this is probably 73, so Title IX had been passed, but the regulations, you had to conform and do a report to the government, but they hadn't really told you how to do it. So I was asked, because I had a background in doing some early women's studies work, if I would take on that role. So I'm very low status at the institution, but I think they did recognize that I would at least ask some questions. And so part of what we did was begin to gather data across, about the admissions policy, how many women versus men were brought in, what are the counseling and employment statistics. It's when I realized that actually 73% of the people working at where I was were women, but I felt like I was one of the few because most of the women that were there were working in cafeteria and as secretaries, et cetera. And so I would just say that one of the most important things Title IX did was ask institutions to pause and monitor themselves to actually see whether in some ways they could see patterns of discrimination that would suggest, not prove, but suggest and raise questions about the allocation of services. So it was a really useful institutional tool for sort of self-examination that I think is probably one of the most important things with Title IX.
Yeah, because Title IX, the regulation, does require a coordinator in each school system and in each college, and readers who have children or interest in their school systems might want to ask, who is the Title IX coordinator and what are they doing? But Title IX increased the awareness of sex discrimination. Many schools and colleges really had never looked at this issue and had no idea. Just to give you one quick example, in the state of Virginia, before Title IX in the 60s, there were 21,000 women who were refused admission to Virginia state colleges and universities, and in the same time, not one man had been rejected. And sort of people hadn't really noticed things like this, and now they had to take notice of it, and so the awareness really made a difference. The other main difference, there are a couple of other things Title IX did. If you saw some discrimination, you had a way to deal with it. You could say, hey, this is illegal, it violates Title IX, and the school would say, oh, well, probably doesn't, and then they'd look into it, and then they'd say, well, your time has come when we have to not do that anymore. Sometimes women teachers in elementary schools were fired when they got pregnant. At colleges, women were often told, I had one letter in my file someone sent me, is your qualifications are excellent, but we already have a woman in this department. So women began organizing, and a lot of the overt policies and practices that were in effect, many of them were just simply changed. And that made, I think, a huge difference because it got rid of the overt things, the policies, official policies and practices that limited women and girls' opportunities. As Karen pointed out, schools began to institutionalize women's issues so that women's issues became important in the institution. You have policies about sexual harassment. You have anti-discrimination policies. Campuses develop a way to handle campus rapes and so forth. So I think these are major things, accomplishments that Title IX did. They not only got rid of the official policies and discriminatory practices, but they just changed the way higher education operated in terms of women. And a lot of the discrimination, not all of it, but a lot of it simply went away.
Well, you mentioned about, you talked a little bit about women students being denied access to even getting into a university at a much higher rate than men. And in one case, the case you mentioned, the men weren't, none of the men were rejected at all. Has Title IX resulted in greater numbers of women being able to go to college? And how are the, as far as you know, how are the numbers in terms of men and women at four-year universities, how have they changed in the last 35 years?
Which one do you want? Go on, Karen.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the things that's, women are now the majority of students, although it varies where, you asked about, there are, I think, just see if I can get those statistics, I think it's 57% of the students overall now are women, and that means women both in the 18 to 22-year-olds as well as over 25. There are differences in where they are. I think if you end up looking at your elite institutions, you will find women, it's more of 50-50 rather than a gender advantage for women. And when you talk about women, you have to say which women and which men, because we still in our country lag behind for men and women of color, so that there's a lot of concern today about the missing men and where are the boys. And those are genuine concerns, particularly when you're talking about men of color, particularly African-American and Hispanic men, as well as low-income men. Otherwise, if you correlate with income, once you correlate with income, the gender disparity not only disappears, but actually returns to a male advantage. So there are really important things that institutions have to do to reach out and to figure out what is keeping and preventing young men of color, particularly African-American and Hispanic, from coming. And that's true of women of color as well, although they are coming in now greater numbers than their male counterparts, particularly Hispanic women and African-American women, but they still aren't coming in parity with their number, you know, at large. But women overall are now getting in at higher rates, and there's always been other things to ask. Men have always been able to come out of high school and go into jobs that give them a livable wage. Women have had to go to school often to make as much as a man without education, and sometimes with an education for a long time, women still made less than men without an education. That's gotten harder now that the salaries are depressed in the industrial areas that men used to be able to get well-paying jobs. But
yeah, one of the things that's interesting about Title IX, it does have a few exemptions, and one of the most important ones is that there is an exemption for admission to private undergraduate colleges, which means the undergraduate college of Harvard or a small private liberal arts college, if they wanted to, could eliminate women completely or have a quota for them even this day. And unfortunately, some of the small private colleges where women are like 60% of the students, some of them are even limiting the number of women who are applying so that they're taking lesser qualified men for those reasons and turning away women who are more qualified. But I want to reiterate what Karen said, is that it's absolutely clear that middle class and well-to-do men are doing fine in schools, both at elementary, secondary, and all the way up through college and post-college. It's the poor people and the people of color who are not. That's where you see the much more gender disparities, because the women are going in higher rates there.
We're talking about Title IX, this being this year being the 35th anniversary since the passage of this law. It was the first comprehensive federal law to prohibit sex discrimination against students and employees of educational institutions. We're discussing that this hour, and you can join our discussion. We'll be going to the phones after we take a short break. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number, and there's a line or two available for you right now. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, please use our local number, 227-2050, 227-2050. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 23 minutes after 10 o'clock. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about Title IX. Coming up later today on the Ideas Network, sometimes life can thwart your dreams. After 5, At Issue, Ben Marins and his guests discuss how to cope with life's disappointments and learn the lessons of strength and resilience. That's after 5 o'clock today on At Issue with Ben Marins here on the Ideas Network. Well, as I mentioned, this hour we're marking the year of the 35th anniversary of the passage of Title IX. And we're taking your calls at 800-486-8655 and 227-2050. My guests this hour, Dr. Bernice Sandler, Senior Scholar, Women's Research and Education Institute. Ms. Sandler played a vital role in the development and passage of Title IX. And also with us by phone, Dr. Karen McTighe-Musil, Senior Vice President, Association of American Colleges and Universities. And as I said, we would go to the phones and take a call. So let's go first to Richard in Fort Atkinson. Richard, good morning.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I work for the American Federation of Teachers, Wisconsin. My work is in the area of employment discrimination, and I specialize in employment discrimination issues in the University of Wisconsin system. And I would like to say that I think I've always thought that Title IX as well as Title VII have been wonderful examples of laws designed to fight discrimination, but that their history over the past several years has been disappointing, much due to the fact that they have received declining support and resources from the federal government. Here within the University of Wisconsin system, if one takes a look at one of its universities, one generally has an affirmative action officer, and then another one, and then there will be another officer in the athletic department, which is called the senior women's administrator, and that is a position mandated by NCAA, and the functions of these people are to monitor compliance with Title IX and Title VII. Many of the people who teach athletics, women's athletics, and they're generally minor sports, that is, they're sports with smaller student enrollments, are adjunct faculty. Most of these people have very little employment security and are essentially employees at will. When the senior women's administrator tries to represent their interests in discrimination cases, she is generally unsuccessful. When they take their issues to affirmative action officers, who are responsible to the president or the chancellor of the institution, they might expect to receive help in our assistance in filing EEOC or Title IX complaints, but because of the delicate position that the affirmative action officer holds, it's worth their employment lives to place the institution in an adversarial position with the federal government. So the obstacles to actually filing successful Title IX complaints are simply huge. And most of the women who start down the road in seeking employment justice will give up because the expenses of prosecuting a case and the time and the pain and the humiliation of confronting people within their own institutions that discriminate are just enormous. In many cases, we welcome people who fight the good fight, but believe me, it is hard. A very tilted table.
Yeah. I wish I could say I'd never heard these sad stories before, but I often work as an expert witness in employment discrimination cases in colleges, and what you say is not limited, certainly, to Wisconsin. Institutions really need to develop ways to deal with these things and to deal with them accurately and speedily and effectively. What sometimes is helpful is to get a committee started, appointed by the university, to gather some information, to show that there are patterns, to show that the policies are not working or that the policies need to be changed. Sometimes that can get the institution, because it's to it started, because it's to their own self-interest to handle this problem well. But it is a difficult one, particularly with adjunct faculty, because their position is so tenuous, or even with untenured faculty, and even with tenured faculty, although they're, of course, less vulnerable than the others. But I would hope, and maybe the University of Wisconsin might be the first to do something like this, to do a study of adjunct professors, if they're primarily female, what's happening to males versus females, what the problems are, and come up with some recommendations which the institution then has to deal with.
And this is Karen. Richard, thank you so much, because I think that's a reminder to us that laws are really important safeguards, and when they don't work, it's even harder, which means you have to have a lot of strategies institutionally, and that Title IX, even when it came, it probably made more progress less because people filed complaints than because institutions shifted their policies and their thinking and began to understand that they were ignoring a whole huge talent base, and in some cases, like the National Science Foundation, understood that if it didn't start pulling women, and white women and men and women of color into the sciences, that we would be in a very difficult position in terms of continuing our role as a leading producer of scientific research. So they understood that it was in the interest of the discipline of the national leadership and of educational advancement to turn to women who had been sort of excluded in disproportionate numbers. So I think it's always good for institutions to have the laws on the books, but to have other remedies beyond the laws, because they won't. They're long, they're painstaking, they're expensive, they're risky, and often they don't have the muscle that a person needs.
Yeah. Go on, Karen. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to end there.
Yeah. In many ways, solving one of these problems by laws is one of the worst ways to solve them. Many of them can be solved much more easily informally or internally with good policies. But Karen's absolutely right. Most of the progress we've made under Title IX was not because people went to court. And the court cases are important, but most of the people never went to court and never had to. They merely had, in many instances, the institution was already changing and needed to be informed of what was happening, and they were willing to change, and often are. Not always, but sometimes.
Though I will say, you know, I can remember a few very dramatic cases where a woman would, Richard, have gone and challenged the sex discrimination, and I won't name the institution, but in one case in which she won, it's one of the best institutions now around sex discrimination because of this lawsuit that gave them, that both embarrassed them, that they lost, and that caused them to say, we really don't want to be known as an institution that is not interested, look at what happened to Larry Summers, is not interested in promoting and advancing women students and women employees. So it acted as a setting the bar high so that they didn't just say, well, we'll pay the money and continue as we did, but it radically transformed the institution and its own goals.
Well, I taught for several years at a University of Minnesota campus.
Uh-huh.
And this was in the 80s, but when I was hired, one of the first things I was told about was the regender decree. And an action. I don't know if it was a lawsuit because it's been a while and my memory tends to be rather foggy.
Yes.
But it was drummed into everybody's head, and anybody who came in knew this is our policy. Here's what we're doing. We want everybody to know this because we don't want you to mess this up.
Yep.
And so there was an example of, you know, there was awareness created and there was a lot of proactive discussion. Mm-hmm. So that when new people came into the pipeline, they were immediately made aware of this is our policy, this is what we want to see happen as an outcome, and we're really serious about this, so please get the message right now.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And I appreciated that because I always like to know where the landmines are to make sure I don't step on them.
Right, and what the institution values, which is also a very positive thing, sort of what we stand for as an institution. So that's a really good thing. I would just like to add, John, to what you said and to this larger conversation, that with the influx of women into the professoriate, into administrative roles, as students, it also, what came were not just the bodies, and partly because of the bodies, but not only women doing this, was a whole new opening up of new scholarship that then put women back into history, put them where we've always been, but sort of our story's not been told about how we contributed to societies, to sustaining them, to inventions, and back into questions about psychological theories. What does it mean? You know, do women go through different sort of stages? We now know there are different paths toward moral development. We know that someone was just telling me about knee replacements, and even in 2007, they have discovered that the knee replacements they've been doing for women have been based on men's knees, and women's, guess what, knees are different. And now there is a whole new, I can't believe it took this long, but we learned long ago that you can't just figure out how to do heart medicine that will work for all people if you only have male subjects. So it really shifted everything as people began to see that paying attention to gender as a lens for understanding and interpreting the world would advance science, would advance knowledge, would advance the quality of what we do. And I think sort of coming to terms with that really moves it from, I have to do this because I've been told to and it's against the law if I don't, to, oh my goodness, how do I draw on this as an asset to accomplish the work I want to do, whether I'm a man or a woman?
One of the things that we've seen happen over the last number of years is sort of a rollback in some areas regarding, for example, affirmative action, the various court cases and so forth that have happened. I'd like to get your insights into what, if any, effect this has had on the progress being made under Title IX. And I don't know who wants to go first there, but...
You go
I'll
first,
toss
Karen,
that out.
Well, I would say that it's been a depressing period. Some of it is has to do with a larger culture of really not standing up in the current administration for equality, and for some of the pullback that Richard spoke of, the support for Title IX coordinators across the state, the elimination. There was an attempt to eliminate the Women's Labor Department role of categorizing and being able to gather documents. The affirmative action, I think, first centered really around race, and that was the famous Michigan cases, and it ended up affecting white women as well, but it was ultimately a very strong reaction against what some small group felt was a favoritism, and affirmative action suddenly became racial preference rather than what it really was to upend and interrupt the racial preference for whites that has characterized our country since our inception and continues to dominate in ways that sometimes we don't see. So I think it has had a chilling effect overall,
but I think that people have been inventive because they understand that this is the future. This is the reality. I just came back from California, where, you know, you're talking about majority people of color in that state by 2050, and it's in some sections of California is majority now. So if they aren't investing in the men and women across all races, they are creating different policies that will help offset the chilling effects of affirmative action. I'll just say one more thing. I think the attack on affirmative action has had its success because the referendums have presented this as a question of fairness, that we don't want to give preference to race. I think if you had a similar one that said we don't want to discriminate against race, you would have people passing that as well. And I think people don't fully understand how that affirmative action has been one of the tools that's helped undo, you know, just centuries of policies that kept people out. And we are really not equitable yet, although we are for white women, but not fully for women of color.
Yeah, I would add that the affirmative action is really a much more generalized backlash against the progress that people of color and women, which includes people of color too, have made. So this is a huge social change. I mean, Title IX and the other laws have had an enormous effect in changing the social roles of men and women. We're not finished with these things yet, but certainly the subservience of women, which some people still believe in, but women's opportunities and people of color's opportunities have just really increased enormously in the last 20, 30, 40 years, depending on when you want to start counting. It doesn't mean that we've accomplished everything, but there's going to be backlash, and this is all part of that. It is both a sign of progress as well as something that's also
true.
Very disappointing at the same time.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't entirely get that backlash thing, and I don't, I guess I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it, but I just don't understand that point of view, and perhaps I need to do more reading, but I don't get it.
Yeah, well, there's a feeling that the preference is being given and that it's unfair, but it goes beyond that. People are upset when things change radically, and certainly what we're saying is, in terms of America's history and the world's history, this is pretty radical stuff. We're going to say people have to be treated fairly and equally, and that's hard for a lot of people, particularly when it begins to sort of go against what they would like in the world. And in their personal relationships, that's probably whatever they want to do is okay as long as it's legal. But when we're talking about employment and schools, there are laws that protect us. And we're going to see this happening. We are seeing it happening. There are a lot of people talking about boys as victims and girls getting all of the preference in schools. And it this simply isn't true. But we hear a lot of talk around that, and it is dangerous talk and upsetting, because it shows that some people really don't want equality in this world.
I also think some of it is a question of a worldview. If you have a worldview that in the United States, if you work hard, you will be, it's the notion of merit, that there will be no barriers to you, is one that many people believe. And I think that's one of the things that's promoted by many people who are against affirmative action. They have a deep belief that an individual just succeeds on their own merit. And it would mean you'd have to ignore large systems that are harder to see. They aren't about individuals. They're about large systems and about histories and about what's happened over time. I've just finished reading the book 13 Moons by the author that did On Cold Mountain. And it's, you know, in the middle of it, there's the Indian Removal Act from North Carolina. And, you know, Indians who had land, property, farms, livestock are just, taken off their lands, and guess who moves in? A group of white people who now have access to free land, and I'm sure the descendants of those people will not see that as having benefited them, that they all, if they only look at their own generation or their own family. So working hard doesn't really you'd have to actually ignore, you know, ways in which there's real stratification, and some of that is income-based, and some of that is race, and some of that is gender, and you know, increasingly around religion. There were lots of quotas, you know, against Jews in my time. You know, I got into school partly because I'm Christian, and there, if you were at some schools, they would say we already have our three Jewish people. So, you know, that there are these deep historical biases that most of us who weren't subject to them are always shocked to discover. I continue to be shocked to discover that these existed, and I think it's really coming to terms with the complexities of our societies and the real commitment to democratic opportunities, which are still out of reach of some people, and really committing ourselves to be part of a genuine democracy that is going to do the hard work of allocating its resources fairly across all of people, so that we have a more level playing field, and we just don't.
Yeah, and you see some of this among young people. One of the things that has begun to happen in many places is girls and boys are friends with each other, even in high school and middle school, and they're not sexual relationships. I have two grandsons, and both of them have female friends whom they talk to. They're not girlfriends. Those are other girls, but they have female friends. And when I went to school, which was a long time ago, that would have been very, very unusual. It's not unusual now, and it shows the changing relationships again between men and women, and Title IX is a piece of that.
800-486-8655 is the toll-free number to join our discussion. We're talking about Title IX this hour. If you're in Milwaukee, please call us at 227-2050, 227-2050. It's been 35 years since the law was passed, and we're taking a look at how far we've come, and we'll probably take a look at how far we have to go as well as we go through this hour. It's a fascinating discussion, and I invite you to join us at 800-486-8655 and 227-2050. As I understand it, there's a compliance test that was instituted by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare under the Carter administration called the three-prong test of compliance. And that's been the subject of some controversy since that was put in place. Why don't we discuss that a little bit, Dr. Sandler? You want to lead off there?
Yeah, we're talking about athletics.
Athletics.
Yeah, many of the issues in Title IX, you look to the legal history of what's happened in race and common sense, and you just come up with some ways of how to deal with it. Because what we're really talking about is a model of integration that, you know, if you can't categorize by sex, you have to find some other category to let people in or out or to do different things. And that works pretty well, except in areas where you have to have some sex segregation. Well, sex education is one where you're allowed to have sex segregation. But in sports, the sex segregation is very critical because you've got football, and that really is the elephant in the living room. I was involved in trying to figure out with a lot of other women, a lot of women lawyers and sports people and so forth, trying to figure out how do you handle athletics under Title IX, because it's sort of like you would have two different bowls of fruit. One would have grapefruit, oranges, grapes, and watermelon, and the other one would have plums and peaches and watermelon and kiwis and maybe three other things. How would you know they're equal? Because men and women are not always doing the same sports. And it's very difficult to figure out a way. We never came up with a way of how we could do this fairly. Everything that any of us came up with had problems with it, and so it is with this particular three-part test, which many people who are opposed to Title IX say the women rammed down the throat of the Department of Education. That couldn't be further than the truth. It was the NCAA, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, which at that point did not handle women's sports. They and the Football Coaches Association came up with this three-part test to determine if the sports programs are equitable. You know, it's easy to say, look, you know, if you let men in the press room, you have to let women in the press room, and now women can go into the press room at the football games, and that's fairly easy. If you're spending recruiting money for men, then you should be spending recruiting money for women. If you're buying new uniforms for men, at some point you have to buy new uniforms for women when they need it instead of giving them the men's uniforms, and these are all real examples. So some are easy, but the big one is, are the programs equal? The three-part test, and institutions choose which of the three they want to do. The first one, I'm not sure of the order, but one is, has the institution has a history of continually expanding the opportunities for the discriminated against sex. There's no standards, there's no time frame, so that seemed to be okay, and I think this is one of the reasons it's in there. Nobody uses that because it's very hard to prove that you've continually expanded the opportunities over time, and 35 years we're talking about. Another one of the three is that the abilities and interests of the sports program takes into account that of the discriminated against sex, so that and again, in the 1970s, that seemed fairly safe, I think, to the Male Athletic Association, because women weren't that interested in sports. They hadn't been allowed to do them. They weren't many programs for them, and they weren't thought to have abilities in sports. I remember seeing an article in Parade magazine, women are lifting free weights. You know, this was a big deal. So that one seemed like a fairly easy way to comply. And the third one is the one which is the most controversial, is the proportion of opportunities for athletic participation is roughly substantially equal to that of the proportion of each gender in the student population at that school. So if your students were 40% men and 60% women, roughly 60% of the athletic opportunities would have to be for women and 40% for men. If you had 50-50, then they'd have equal number of opportunities. And schools get to choose what they want to do, how they want to have those, choose which sports they want to have for each gender. A lot of people say this is a quota system because it's based on the proportion of men and women, and the courts have consistently said, no, it's not a quota system, because the school gets to choose. If it chooses to get rid of wrestling and swimming and golf for men and increase the football team, that's the school's decision, if that's what it wants to do. And that's part of the problem that we have, is schools do not want to reduce the amount of money or the amount of scholarships or the amount of walk-ons or any of their athletic costs of football. And as a result, we still have a lot of disparities. I would say we've made substantial progress in many areas, virtually all areas that Title IX covers. We've made good progress in sports and athletics. We've gone from horrendous to very bad because of the sex segregation and the resistance to this, we still have a lot of problems in sports. I'll just say one other thing, and then I'll stop and let Karen add to this. This is, I get calls almost every month from some parent in a middle or high school, a parent of a student in middle or high school, who says, the girls' soccer field is not a regulation soccer field, the men's is. The girls' soccer field doesn't have lockers, it doesn't have bathrooms, it doesn't have nightlights, and they go on and on and list a bunch of things, all of which the boys' soccer fields have. The 2007, we are still dealing with that problem. So we have a long way to go to sports.
And I'll just put the happy spin on it because I'm looking at this. And I think what you say is absolutely true, yeah. Bunny. I'm reading from a little piece in the Ms. Special magazine on Title IX, referring to a book called Equal Play, Title IX and Social Change by Nancy Hogshead Maker, M-A-K-A-R, and Andrew Zimbalist, who edited this. And in 1971, only 1 in 27 girls played high school sports, and today almost half of high school girls play. And I came from a suburban high school outside of Philadelphia where we had rigorous women's sports. And when I went to Duke, I was shocked to discover that most schools in the South didn't have interscholastic sports. And these very talented athletes that could outplay me in our, of course, we didn't have intercollegiate women's sports at Duke when I was there. And, of course, now its basketball team is, you know, one of the best in the nation. But then, you know, they were very talented, but they just hadn't played sports. So the good news is that it rekindled women and took us out of the bleachers and onto the playing fields. And sports are really good for men and good for women. They are good for your bodies. They teach you a lot of risks, courage. There's lots of studies done about ways in which it has things beyond the physical benefits. And so that part is really important, which is why I think people are struggling to resist the efforts to weaken Title IX's compliance issues in sports, because it has made such a difference for the girls today.
We need to take a break, and when we come back, we've got a couple of callers who want to join us, and we'll want to get them in before the top of the hour. So let's go to a break, and then we'll come back and take some phone calls. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:53. Coming up after 11 this morning, if your personal computer is not performing to your expectations, you can get some advice. Personal computer consultant Peter Green of InfoStar is Larry Mueller's guest coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about Title IX, and the reason is, well, this is the 35th anniversary. This year is the 35th anniversary of the passage of this landmark legislation. It was the first comprehensive federal law to prohibit sex discrimination against students and employees of educational institutions. And we've been spending the hour talking about Title IX and its effects and how far we still have to go in some areas with Dr. Bernice Sandler, Senior Scholar, Women's Research and Education Institute, and Dr. Karen McTighe-Musil, Senior Vice President, Association of American Colleges and Universities. We've got some callers who are waiting to join us. Let's go to Jackie in Sheboygan.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hi. I have a question about physical education classes and whether that falls under the Title IX umbrella. I have three daughters, middle and high school daughters, who regularly complain that because they have to have PE classes with boys, that they don't get time handling the ball. The boys manipulate and overpower the girls, and they don't get playing time. And last week something happened where the girls had to play by themselves. My daughter came home. She was so excited. She said, "Mom, we actually played a game. We cooperated. They had so much fun." And I don't know that single sex necessarily discriminates against women. I think there may be a place for single sex. Certainly Leonard Sachs advocates the strengths of single sex education, and I think maybe PE classes might be a way where that would do the same.
We have a history of PE classes before Title IX, and unfortunately they weren't equal, and people are rethinking that. But clearly what's going on in that class is that the girls are being treated very differently than the boys. I don't know if the school is aware of it. I don't know if the person in charge of PE is aware of it, but it clearly sounds from what you've told me like it's a violation. They are giving the boys preference.
I did mention it to the teacher, and he acted like, well, it's the girl's responsibility to get in there and make a way for themselves. You know, if the boys pass it to one another, that's not the girl's problem. You know, they need to get in there and get it.
He needs to talk to the boys if they're only passing it to boys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They probably need to be reminded about Title IX. You might want to contact the Women's Sports Foundation. They have an 800 number. They're in Long Island, New York, and they probably could give you some help on how to deal with that.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you for your
Thanks
question.
Thanks for the call, Jackie.
Sure.
Let's take a call from Randy in Marshfield next. Randy, good morning.
How are you doing? I've heard the conversation for like the last 20 minutes, and it seems to be all female based. And I got in, I was going into a store and didn't hear your question about the athletics. My question is athletics. You know, they had a case in Stevens Point where they don't have a gymnastics team for boys; they do for girls. The boy wanted to do gymnastics. They said he couldn't. They went to court, and the court decided he could not do gymnastics with the girls. I'm also a coach, or I was a coach, for a junior high baseball team. They have baseball and softball. Softball for the girls. The girls, one of the girls wanted to play baseball. She didn't know how to handle the bat, didn't know how to hold it. She was awful. As a coach, I acted like she was just one of the people, but one of the players. But from my standpoint, why did she get to play baseball when they had a softball team, but the boy couldn't play softball?
I'm not sure how they handle baseball and softball. They're usually seen as different. They have different rules, and usually they might be seen as somewhat equal. There's one case in California where they built a huge new facility for baseball for the boys, spent several million dollars on, and did nothing for the girls, and then they had to do something for softball. So I'm not sure. I think what happens is schools decide whether they want to have a gymnastics team for which gender, and that's their decision. In some instances, if there's no team available for the other sex, they can be allowed in. And that's one thing to check out. Again, the Women's Sports Foundation would know about that. And you could also ask the Title IX officer, although sometimes they're not that knowledgeable in a school system. So I don't have the answer for you on that.
We've got about 30 seconds left, and I'd like to kind of try to wrap things up here. Can we, in 30 seconds, is it possible for us to make any predictions about where we're going to be, say, 5 or 10 years from now with Title IX?
I hope we'll be further along than we are. I used to think we'd finish Title IX in 1 year, and I clearly was wrong. We still have a long way to go. Progress comes slowly, but there are a lot of people out there working on these issues. This is the most important law passed probably since women got the right to vote. It also offers opportunities for men as well as women, and it is an important law, and we're going to work on it for a long, long time.
And I would just say, I think that the new framing for gender equity is that it's not just for women's behalf, but it really is an asset for all of us, and it helps us become the kind of society we want. And I remain optimistic because of the new generation of women who are now coming into professional roles and into congressional roles that will help us continue to keep Title IX a vibrant and important law.
Thank you both for spending this hour.
Thank you.
I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network.